Good morning and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute and New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. And we're going to try our best to cast a little sunshine on the ways in which government is doing and not doing the people's business. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Susan Arbetter, the Emmy Award-winning news director for WCNY in Syracuse and the producer and host of the Capitol Press Room, a syndicated radio show that is heard each weekday on radio stations throughout New York State. And at about 8:35 this morning, we will be speaking with Stephanie Miner, the mayor of the city of Syracuse. But before we hear from Susan Arbetter and Mayor Stephanie Miner, let's get a quick report from our co-hosts, Brian McDonald and Ron Deutsch, about the developments of the last several weeks since the legislature completed its regular session for 2015. Brian, what's happened that's noteworthy from a political and legislative perspective?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things that happened is the clash of the titans between the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, and Governor Cuomo on June 30th, immediately after the legislative session ended, and the mayor was frustrated by his inability to get a number of his most important things done. The mayor held an interview at New York One. He talked about the governor's game playing. He said that the governor was motivated by a desire for revenge, and he said that he was disappointed with not just how the legislative session went, but how the governor had performed during budget negotiations and during legislative negotiations. What was fascinating to me was this is something that, you know, everybody had known that the relationship had been deteriorating. It's one of those things that everybody knew but no one had said. And it was very unusual for the mayor to come out in such a public forum to talk about some of the things about the governor that some of us have observed for a long time, but, you know, people had not said publicly.
Right. I think it was amusing to watch, too, because it's like you've had this situation where they've claimed to be like just best friends and, you know, old chums for a long time. And you knew that that relationship wasn't going to continue in that way. And clearly it's deteriorated to the point now where, you know, the governor is giving quotes to news outlets, and claiming it's from top administration officials and not even himself. So although he certainly didn't deny that. And it's kind of common knowledge that that's what he's been doing now. So it's interesting to see this dynamic. And it's, I mean, I think the other thing that's interesting to watch is the fact that, you know, fewer and fewer politicians are living in fear of this governor. And they're pretty clear about the fact that, you know, as his poll numbers drop, so has his power and his hold over the reins of Albany. So I think you're seeing a lot of that now where people are willing to speak out against the policies of the Cuomo administration and kind of fight back.
Well, you mentioned that, the governor had, the people had suspected that the governor had been the source behind some of these critical comments about the mayor. It was interesting that the mayor came out right out and said, you know, the governor and his minions sometimes say things about me. I'm going to come to you and tell you exactly how I feel. You know, a reminder that the mayor had sort of been shoring up the governor's left flank. He had been critical in gaining the Working Families Party support for the governor's reelection bid last summer. You know, I think the governor would not have received that endorsement if not for the mayor's influence. So a lot of people had been watching this for a while, saying, when is the mayor going to, you know, push back against the governor? And we saw it pretty loudly and pretty clearly.
Oh, yeah, he pushed.
Governor Cuomo's response was sort of that the mayor wants Albany to be different than Albany. So the governor sort of is taking the position that you can't change Albany.
Well, isn't that what the governor claimed originally that he wanted to do was change Albany?
Well, we'll see.
Right?
But we're now pleased to be joined on the telephone by Susan Arbetter, the Emmy Award-winning news director for WCNY in Syracuse and the producer and host of the Capitol Press Room, a syndicated radio show heard each weekday on radio stations throughout New York State. Susan, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure. How are you guys today?
Doing wonderful. This is Ron Deutsch, and I also want to welcome our guest, Susan Arbetter, the People's Business here on WRPI in Troy. Susan produced and hosts the Capitol Press Room, which is a daily one-hour radio program broadcast from the Legislative Correspondents Association Press Room, that wonderful cube on the third floor that
it's
you call
hut,
home.
Ron.
It's a hut. The hut.
It's a plywood hut.
It's a beautiful plywood hut, though,
you.
I have to say. And your show features interviews with government officials, advocates, and others involved in governmental and political processes in New York State. You also feature analysis by seasoned political reporters who work the Albany beat for newspapers and wire services around the state. And through syndication, your interviews on the Capitol Press Room are available every weekday to listeners in virtually all of upstate New York on radio stations ranging from Westchester County, just north of New York City, to Buffalo and Jamestown in the western reaches of the state. So you've been doing your daily show, The Capitol Press Room, just about 6 years now, which is hard to believe.
I know. It's gone that fast,
right? I mean, so let me ask you, I mean, why do you do this type of work? And, you know, how does that affect the factors you try and balance in putting together the Capitol Press Room each day? It must be difficult to really pull together a show as diverse as yours on a daily basis.
Well, I have some phenomenal help in my producer, Alyssa Plock. So it's the two of us who put this show together every day. But let's go back, you know, 6 years or something. Let's go back 7 years. Or even 8 years. I was at another radio station for a really long time, and I probably could have stayed there, you know, resting comfortably on, as long as I probably would have wanted to do. But I wanted another challenge and thought that I could find it in television. And I realized, you know, what I really want to do is get people who don't, who feel like state government isn't important to them, to get them to pay attention and get them to actually vote. If one person goes to the voting booth because of something that they heard on the Capitol Press Room, I feel that that's, you know, a huge victory. A lot of people, I mean, you know, Frank, you know, Ron, people don't vote. And it's a problem for them that they don't vote, but I don't think they realize it. And so what I'm trying to do with the Capitol Press Room is make, is sort of bring a fun, humorous, but smart look at politics into the cars and the homes of regular people. While I think a lot of people might assume that this show is just for the bubble, it's not. It's actually just for, you know, it's for regular, normal people, like the mom who's driving her kids to, you know, pre-K and getting, you know, stoned or getting thrown, you know, not stoned. I'm sorry.
That's Colorado.
About that. My listeners don't do that.
Different state.
Yeah, stop talking about my mom.
Yeah, so, you know, she's getting pelted with, you know, Flintstone cereal or something from the back seat. That's who my audience is.
This is Brian McDonald, and I'd also like to welcome our guest, Susan Arbetter, to The People's Business on WRPI Troy. Before starting the Capitol Press Room in August of, 2009, our guest, Susan Arbetter, developed, produced, and hosted the premier statewide PBS television news program on state politics that everybody watched, New York Now. It was carried on all 9 New York State PBS channels. Susan, can you tell us a little bit about the difference between doing radio versus TV and how you balance doing a daily show as opposed to the weekly show?
Right. That's a great question. TV is such a pain in the neck. I cannot even begin to tell you. I still do a half-hour TV show for WCNY, but a lot of the heavy lifting is done by folks in Syracuse, people who actually are, you know, good at TV. I like to ask people questions and stuff, but I'm not a TV person. I'm a radio person, and it's so much more intimate. You guys probably realize this. You can be much less formal. You don't have to sit up. You can wear your pajamas. You can, you know, you don't have to put on your makeup, right, Ron? And it's just, you know, very relaxed. It also gets other people relaxed, which is what I really love. You can, later on today, I'll be having, you know, Pete Lopez on. He's a Republican assemblyman from upstate New York.
Sure.
And he, you know, I think that he, speaking for him, he hasn't said this to me, but I'm betting that he feels a lot more comfortable just chit-chatting with me on the radio than he would sitting in front of cameras under hot lights in front of a television, a bank of television cameras. And you get a lot more out of it, and people become more human. That's why I love doing it.
Well, I think it's your personality, though, that kind of draws that out in people.
Well, clearly.
I've been on the show before, and I have to say you're absolutely right. I mean, you do really have a very kind of comfortable atmosphere in there, and I think people feel at ease to talk about the issues. So
I appreciate
kudos
that.
To you. Yes.
And that's actually the whole idea. I mean, for 13 years, I was at this other station talking about things like, you know, the best creme brulee recipe. Okay, and yes, we also talked about important things like Darfur and the Hudson River pollution and things like that. But that's really where I learned to just have a chit chat on the radio and make it pointed and make it, you know, it's not just fluff, but people feel comfortable, and that's the point.
We're speaking with Susan Arbetter, the host of the daily radio show, The Capitol Press Room, which is heard on radio stations throughout New York State. On Twitter, you can follow Susan at Sarbetter, S-A-R-B-E-T-T-E-R, first initial and last name, at Sarbetter, and you can follow her radio show, The Capitol Press Room, at Cap Press Room. Susan, do you have any interaction with your listeners? Do you ever hear from them? Do you do events around the state?
Well, not as much as I would like to be perfectly honest. So we did have this one event on the day that the home station that pays my paycheck is WCNY in Syracuse, and they just built this new station right in downtown Syracuse, right on West Fayette Street. I don't know if you're familiar with that area, but it's a pretty blighted community. Anyway, on the day of the grand opening, I did a live Capitol Press Room in the station, and I was floored by how many people showed up. And after the show was over, they stayed, and they started asking questions. We were talking about, what were we talking about? Wood smoke. The wood smoke controversy, how, you know, a lot of the forest industries would like to sell you things like little wood pellets, but they're really not that great for the environment. So a lot of people showed up for that, and we stayed, and they stayed and talked for about 45 minutes. But I would love to do some live stuff around the state. It's so much fun to go out and talk to people about what they're interested in and what's important to them. Right now, we don't have the technical capability of doing that, but I'm hoping that that changes very soon. We've tried it a couple of times, but you really need to rely on the technology.
You did a couple of sessions in different parts of the state on the Common Core. Is that?
Yes,
those were quite exciting.
That was fun. Yeah, it was quite exciting. There are some very angry people, as I'm sure you know, about the Common Core. So what these were televised live forums about the Common Core. One of them took place at WCNY and featured State Ed Commissioner Dr. John King and Anthony Botar, who is one of the regents. Then we did another one at WSKG in Binghamton, and that one featured Merrill Tisch and Jim Tallon and Dr. John King. And both of them were pretty, I don't want to say they were raucous, because that has a negative connotation. They were lively, and they were, it was clear that a lot of people have a lot of serious, deep-seated concerns, not only about the new standards and whether or not they're appropriate for their children and the age of their children, but also about the amount of testing and the way the whole thing was rolled out. My job, I felt, was to ensure that people got heard, that the people who are on the panel, people like the chancellor and the regents, understood the kernel of the question that these participants were asking, and then I asked follow-up questions so, you know, nobody could skirt the issue. I think they went well. Of course, we still have the Common Core, so, you know, we'll see what that brings.
But it's a developing subject. So, Susan, you're a longtime observer of New York politics and of Albany in particular. Later today, we're going to have the mayor of Syracuse, Stephanie Miner, on the show. She has been a pretty vocal critic of the governor. previously, before you came on, we were discussing how Mayor de Blasio had come out recently firing against the governor. Can you tell us some of your observations about this legislative session and how this may have been different from previous years that you've observed?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I'm a huge admirer of Mayor Stephanie Miner. She has been someone to step up to the governor and doesn't seem to be afraid of him. Even back when I think that there was a lot of fear surrounding him, and you know, he had a lot more political capital at the beginning of his tenure as governor, and you know, nobody wanted to say boo about it. But that's definitely deteriorating. That's one of the main themes, I think, going into next session that we're going to be exploring, which is how the governor's political capital has really been not tapped out, but it's certainly, you know, the what's in the bank account is pretty low. There's change there. And he's also made some really serious missteps, I think. Like, look at the whole de Blasio, Cuomo. I think both of them have really hurt the institutions that they serve. There's no reason to have this sort of ridiculous, childish back and forth. Someone's got to be the adult in the room, and neither one of them is doing it. I sort of feel bad for Mayor de Blasio, who, you know, he was just sort of sitting back and taking it. Yes, you need to fight back, but if he continues down this path, he's going to lower himself to where the governor is. You need to be, you know, our elected officials have so much working against them with, you know, campaign problems and corruption. They at least need to appear like they are adults.
So let me ask you this. I mean, speaking of the governor, you seem to have the governor on more than anybody, in fact. I mean,
well, you know why that is, right?
No. Why don't you tell us?
Because he had a falling out with Fred Dicker.
Right, right.
And so, you know, Fred is another radio host, the other radio host here at the state capitol. And the governor and Fred Dicker have known each other for a long, long time. And at the beginning of his tenure as governor, he went on Fred's show a lot. Then he did a few things that apparently Fred disapproved of, and he needed to find another venue. And, you know, I was the other one. I was in the right place at the right time. At the beginning, I think I was a little, you know, I didn't know what to do with the governor. Now I feel much more comfortable just sort of throwing it back at him. And we've had some good back and forth lately. I'm not sure if he'll come back, but we'll see.
Right. I mean, how's that work then? Do they contact you
of
and
course.
Say, we want to be on today and, you know, bump all your other guests because I'm more important? Or
you
know,
you've been bumped, Ron.
I guess I won't feel
too
bad.
That's the real issue here, I think, that Ron really wants to talk
yes,
about.
Yes, I'm bitter. I'm just bitter, Susan. Darn it. No, I mean, you know, I guess I just wonder, you know, he comes on your show. He doesn't do interviews generally. I mean, you know, you certainly don't see him doing any real TV interviews.
No.
He did one with New York One recently, and he'll do them with national TV outlets and CNN and stuff like that. But
so wait a second. Susan, we will know that the governor's political capital has gone way down when you say, Governor, I can't have you on today. I've got Ron Deutsch on earlier today. I'm sorry.
I live for that day.
Well, but
Susan.
Susan's explained earlier why the governor doesn't want to do television. It's
those right,
hot,
right.
It's those hot lights.
Right, right. they'll melt me. So the other question I have for you, though, is I think you do a really good job kind of balancing the issues, and I don't know how consciously you all do that between you and your producer, Alyssa.
Oh, Alyssa,
you know,
and I work very
continually,
hard.
Yeah, you pick guests and make sure you kind of balance both sides of the scales to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think that sometimes my personal feelings might squeak out there occasionally.
Just a little.
But we do try to balance it. I mean, for example, today we have, I mentioned Republican Pete Lopez. We also have Jake Palmateer on, who's someone who's a strong Second Amendment supporter, and Rob Astorino.
Right.
We also have Dr. Carpenter, who, of course, you know, is somebody who, you know, runs the UAlbany Environment and Health Institute. And, you know, we try to hear what my goal here is to hear from all sides. what I don't want to do is become, I mean, as much as I absolutely love Democracy Now, don't get me wrong, I can't, it's not my mission to just present the progressive view. Right. I have to present all the views. However, unlike many other commercial stations and other commercial radio shows, I will present the progressive view, which, you know, frankly, in this country has become more and more marginalized, except on your station.
Yeah. one issue that I think has demonstrated a commitment to this balance and really a long-term commitment to the issue and educating people about it is the fact that you have people from all different perspectives on the fracking debate, and you've had them on for so long. You maintain an objective perspective that gives everyone the opportunity to share their views. So I think what you've done on the fracking issue over time is a great example of that.
Thank you very much. We just had Bob Howarth on the other day, and he's one of the main scientists behind the Jacobson study, which is something that says, you know, we really could go full bore into you know, renewables if we wanted to. He was talking about methane, and methane is also an issue with the pipeline. So even though the fracking debate is over, the fracking infrastructure debate has really just begun. So we will be continuing to do that. And I also want to just say one thing, Frank, that the fracking debate, there are some issues that are, you know, pro and con. The fracking debate was like an octagon. It had eight different, you know, perspectives. You could be someone who really was angry with the oil and gas industry, but you own land and you had a lease. You could be someone who was just, you know, on the sidelines but didn't want all the trucks to go through your lawn or through your through the roads through the town, and didn't know how the municipality was going to pay for it. It's a crazy issue, and it was actually. I really admire people, reporters like Tom Wilbur and John Campbell, who have just immersed themselves in the science and the politics of it.
We're speaking with Susan Arbetter, who's the news director for WCNY in Syracuse, a public radio station, and you also do things on WCNY television, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and she's the producer and host of the Capitol Press Room, a syndicated radio show that's heard each weekday on radio stations throughout New York State. Susan, sometimes a very local issue takes on statewide importance. This seems to be the case with the controversy surrounding the East Ramapo School District in Rockland County, which you've given some informative coverage to lately. What do you make of what's going on?
Well, I feel that this is an issue that has everything. I mean, the drama, the pathos, and it's so important. These public school kids aren't getting a sound basic education because of the decisions of the East Ramapo School Board. And, you know, the monitor that was appointed by Governor Cuomo, Hank Greenberg, who went down there and issued a report, said, you know, there's no illegality here, but it's clear that the board is making decisions based on a preference for the religious schools. So as a Jew and as someone in the religious schools are run by ultra-Orthodox Jews, and as a Jew, I just felt, oh, this is, you know, this is reminiscent, Frank, of the kind of back and forth that we had back in the 60s when, you know, Albert Shanker was the do you remember the school board?
Yes, yeah.
The union guy.
Ocean Hill, yeah. Brownsville.
Yes, exactly. And my mom was a school teacher at PS1. And she used to tell us about these very painful fights between, you know, that pitted the mostly white school teachers against the mostly African American students. And I could just see this seething tension bubbling up again in East Ramapo, and it's not good for anybody. And I just felt that because the ultra-Orthodox community is growing at such an enormous pace, we're going to see more of these kinds of issues. And the way we talk about race and religion and culture is, of course, more than just a local thing. It's it's on a national scale.
Well, what's been fascinating about that story is how one segment of the population was able to sort of rally their base, exercise political power, take over a political institution, in this case the school board, and then sort of look out for their own interests as opposed to the broader population. And as much as the broader population has tried to sort of push back against this, they haven't had the political muscle to do anything about it. So it's a fascinating story to watch. And many of our listeners are probably not familiar with it, but it's a very interesting story that's happening, you know, just a few hours south of us.
And did you see last week Governor Cuomo vetoed a Scoofus-Larkin bill that would have ensured more oversight over annexation of land by Kiryas Joel, which is another ultra-Orthodox community in the Hudson Valley? We're going to see many, many more issues that arise from this, and it's important that we're able to talk about these issues and we don't point to each other and say, oh, you are a self-hating Jew, or you are anti-Semitic, or you are racist, or anything like that. We need to have real, substantive conversations without it degenerating into that kind of name-calling.
Agreed.
So I wanted to ask you, too, you obviously work with many great reporters over there on the third floor the Capitol, and you have the Legislative Correspondents Association over there. You are going to be taking over as president of the LCA, I hear. I'm just wondering, under Susan Arbetter, how will things change over there in the LCA press room?
Well, my reign of tyranny has begun, Ron.
Is there a crown outside the hut now?
I wear a sash. Oh,
okay.
The biggest issue I think facing us is one that's a challenge, but it's sort of a positive challenge. We're running out of space. We need to find more space for all of the reporters who want space in the LCA press room. I mean, I'm sure that you guys remember back in, like, under Pataki, this place was a desert. You could see tumbleweeds, rolling through. But now, with, Capital New York has six people, WNYC is going to be bringing a full-time reporter up here. We have a TV, a bunch of TV stations have sent from Central New York have sent a correspondent to work here full time. I mean, we really just need to either rearrange some furniture or ask OGS for another spot, because so that's going to be my main issue. The other big issue for us is the archive. We have, this is a 115-year-old organization, and that puts on a show every year, and a lot of the stuff is very, it's worthwhile, and historians, political historians, could use it. For example, remember Hillary Clinton, when she was first lady, performed the rebuttal at the 2000 LCA show. She's running for president now. It's going to be of interest to historians and other reporters covering her campaign. So we need to get that in order, and we've chosen the SUNY Archive to be the home for all of this ephemera. And so it's going to be under my watch when we transfer everything from, like, the schmutzy boxes that we have here into the archive.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we've been speaking with Susan Arbetter, the Emmy Award-winning news director for WCNY in Syracuse, and the producer and host of The Capitol Press Room, a syndicated radio show heard each weekday on radio stations throughout New York State. On Twitter, you can follow Susan at SRBetter, at SRBetter, and you can follow her radio show, The Capitol Press Room, at Cap Press Room. Susan, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Oh, this has been such a pleasure. Tell Stephanie Miner I said, hey.
Well, yeah, thanks, Susan. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
After a brief break, we'll be back to speak with Stephanie Miner, who Susan just mentioned. Stephanie Miner is the mayor of the city of Syracuse, and we look forward to speaking to her. But now we'll take a break and be back in a few minutes.
Hello, this is Mark O'Connor, and when I'm in Troy, I listen to WRPI Troy.
careful at the party, hon. No alcohol, right?
I know, Mom.
Seriously, you're still growing, and it messes with your judgment.
Yeah, I know.
Trust me, you could do some things you don't really want to do. If you're a grown woman, it's different, but you're not.
I know, okay? I know.
Teenagers know everything. So talk about underage drinking before they know it all. Before they're teens. Start talking before they start drinking. And keep talking. Learn more at StopAlcoholAbuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Good morning and welcome back to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute and New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. And in a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with Stephanie Miner, the mayor of the city of Syracuse. Mayor Miner has, in addition to serving as mayor, she's now in her fifth or sixth year as mayor. She was reelected in 2013, and she was on the city council before that. So she seems to have a very good understanding of the issues facing the cities of upstate New York, and we're going to have a chance to talk with her about that. One of the challenges facing the upstate cities, Ron, that you've focused on over the years, which is probably interrelated with a lot of the other challenges facing the upstate cities, is really the high poverty rates, particularly the high child poverty rates in the upstate cities. What do you think explains this situation that sometimes you come close to, in cities like Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse, you sometimes come close to half the children living in families below the poverty line?
Yeah, it's even in some of these cities, it's even more than half the children living below the poverty line when you're talking about cities like Rochester. So I think it's a problem that's been overlooked for far too long, and we're not focused on it. Now, the governor, in his budget address and in his executive budget and in the final budget, actually pulled together kind of a poverty task force to look at the city of Rochester, and then that got expanded a little bit. But again, it's kind of this piecemeal approach, I think, where the governor kind of goes city by city and announces different initiatives here and there. Right. You know, I mean, I'm sure Syracuse would like their own $1 billion. You know, they had a hard time just getting the $16 million that they requested. Yet there's a significant child poverty problem in Syracuse, as is the case with every upstate city. So, you know, I think it's unconscionable that we continue to let this go on when there are a lot of things that we could be doing that we're certainly not doing right now.
Well, we're now pleased to be joined on the telephone by the mayor of the city of Syracuse, Stephanie Miner. Mayor Miner, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
This is Brian McDonnell, and I'd like to welcome our guest, Stephanie Miner, to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Mayor Miner was elected to the Syracuse City Council as a councilor at large in 2001. She was reelected to that position in 2005. She was elected mayor of the city of Syracuse in 2009 and was reelected in 2013. Mayor, based on your experiences to date, what do you see as the short and long-term prospects for the city of Syracuse specifically? And can you talk a little bit about some of the older industrial cities of the Northeast and Midwest generally?
Well, I think they're actually both kind of the same question. The future for cities is remarkably bright. That's where all economic development is happening in the 21st century, because as we have a knowledge-based economy in a global world, where we're seeing the most development happen is where you have a concentration of intellectual firepower and the kind of cross-pollination that happens when you get diverse groups of people together, and that's, of course, cities. So the city of Syracuse is experiencing incredible burgeoning growth in downtown and with our nonprofits, our educational institutions, and our medical institutions. The problem becomes, and particularly with older industrial northeastern cities in particular, that we have infrastructure that needs to be updated and maintained. And unfortunately, the federal government and the state government have sort of walked away from that responsibility. So the older the city is, the more their water mains and bridges and roads need help, particularly when you have climates like Syracuse and Buffalo and Rochester, Cleveland, for that matter, where Chicago, where you have a lot of snow and as a consequence, a lot of salt to remove that. And that does a lot of damage on concrete.
Yeah, not to mention sub-zero temperatures and all of that. This is Ron Deutsch. I also want to welcome our guest, Mayor Stephanie Miner, to the People's Business here on WRPI in Troy. So you brought up, you know, the cities are the hubs of economic development now, and certainly that seems to be the case. But I guess, you know, I'm wondering your thoughts on some of New York State's policies towards our urban centers around New York State, and particularly in upstate New York. When we talk about economic development, when we talk about infrastructure, things seem to be rather selective now. And it seems like one city will get money and another city won't, or will create a competition among regions to get money. I mean, do you think that this is a good approach generally, or do you think that it's a bit misguided?
I'm not in favor of that approach, which I would also say is kind of runs rampant throughout all of governments, in that it's just an ad hoc basis. And then you say, oh, okay, well, we're going to solve this problem, and you spend a year on it, and then you move on to another one. Education, infrastructure, economic development needs sustained investment and time for policies to take hold and make changes. And unfortunately, there politicians find it easier to cut ribbons, claim victory, and move on than to do any real sustainable investment in public policy and in matters that really are, you know, the politicians and the elected officials that went before us that built the Erie Canal, the remnants of which I'm looking at right now, or built the Thruway, or, you know, these other huge investments in economic development where they said, look, we may not see the return next year or even in our election cycle, but we know that there's going to be a return for the people of our community. And whether it was the Tappan Zee Bridge or the subway system or the Southern State Parkway or the Thruway, that's where you started to see those kind of investments really make a difference in New York State's economy.
Is there an urban concern in the regional economic development competition that Ron alluded to? I think the way most of our listeners might remember this is, as part of the budget this year, the governor proposed, and I think the legislature ultimately went along with without changes, a process by which there would be a competition among most but not all of the regions of the state, and the prize would be three awards of $500 million each. In that process, do you see a glimmer of hope for the state's cities?
I do, and certainly I would tell you that anybody who is an advocate for the state cities is in there right now putting together proposals and working with our partners to have the best proposals that we can have to win the competition. But again, you know, I would much rather have sustained public policy aimed at looking at these problems across the board rather than pocket by pocket or city versus city.
We've talked a lot about economic development on this show, and you know, with the number that's thrown around is that the state of New York spends about $7 billion each year in economic development. Some of it is not tracked. You know, a lot of it has no clawbacks. A lot of recipients of state aid don't actually create jobs. I think it was you. We had a conversation with Mayor Gary McCarthy of the city of Schenectady, and I think we talked about one of the things that you had said during the budget process, that a reliable water system is economic development, to know that, you know, the businesses in your community can rely on the water and sewer system. Now, that's not as flashy as cutting all these ribbons that you've talked about, but do you think that's a good use of economic development money?
Look, all you have to do is see what's going on in California and the desperate straits that they are in and what the rest of the world is going through in droughts to see that water is going to be the oil of our generation. Hmm. And we are blessed with having not just lots of water, but it's clean and it's usable and it's environmentally sustainable and friendly. So I think that's absolutely where we as a state should be making investments, because it is good for all of us. It's a better bedrock of what we depend on. And there are other places in the world and in the country where people are going to be looking to move from because they don't have access to it.
That's interesting. Maybe we, instead of a we're open for business ad campaign, we could say we've got water. Come to Syracuse. be our new economic development program. I guess I would wonder, too. I mean, you know, we had this bank settlement funds, right? We had about $6 billion that the state government got from bank settlements with banking institutions and other bad players, supposedly in the financial crash. And, you know, I guess I was certainly a frequent critic of how that money was being spent. I didn't feel that enough of it went into infrastructure. And as Frank and I also pointed out, you know, we had this Upstate Hunger Game competition for economic development money. Do you think that that money could have been better spent? And do you think that the lion's share of it should have, in fact, gone for things like infrastructure repair? Because oftentimes we hear from business, you know, when they choose to locate in an area, they're looking for two basic things. One is the skill level of the workforce, and the other is the infrastructure in the area. Can I get my goods and services to market? So, you know, I guess I would suggest that in terms of economic development, infrastructure is a big piece of that to attract business. And I was just wondering your thoughts on the settlement money and on that kind of infrastructure as economic development.
Yeah, I wrote a lot as that settlement money was coming in. I wrote op-eds to the Times Unions and other places and talked about the fact that we should use all of the money for infrastructure, because both the fact that we had this windfall in settlement money combined with the low interest rates that we have, and when you're doing infrastructure projects, almost 50% of infrastructure projects ends up being interest rate costs. So that is to say, with low interest rates, we could almost double how much infrastructure investment we could have done with this windfall. And while the rest of the country had bridges falling down and dams leaking and water pipes not working, we could have been investing in that, also investing in broadband. We could have told people what we were going to, how we were going to pay for the Tappan Zee Bridge, helped Long Island in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy with some of their sewage and water issues. And then upstate, you know, roads, bridges, water mains is a particular favorite of mine. So I thought it was a really a way to get ahead, given that money that we had. And at the time of the election year, you saw business people saying the same thing, you saw labor saying the same thing, and you saw candidates saying the same thing. So when you have everybody on the same page, singing from the same songbook, one would assume that that was going to happen. But unfortunately, January came, and it was decided that an economic development competition would be a better use of the resources. I disagreed, but that's not the first time that that's happened.
So I think a lot of people came away from this legislative session, this last year's legislative session, a little frustrated. Before you came on the show today, we had Susan Arbetter, who, as you know, is a radio show host who does a daily show on politics in the Capitol in Albany. And we were also discussing how Mayor Bill de Blasio from New York City had expressed his frustration at the end of the legislative session, not just with that he didn't get everything that he wanted during the session, but with the governor's particular style of governing. You have also not been shy about mentioning when you have differences with the governor. Can you talk a little bit about some of the frustrations that you've had in trying to get your agenda successfully pushed through in Albany?
You know, look, as a mayor myself, I can tell you that every time you have a legislative agenda, you have a budget process, everybody always walks away a little bit frustrated, and nobody ever gets everything that they want. The difference is that the process in Albany seems to be shrouded in mystery, so there's no explanation of why you didn't get what you want, or there's no rational basis that's presented to you. Rather, on March 31st, all of the Assembly members and Senate members rush to vote on something, and then when you call them, if you can get a return phone call, and you start asking them questions, for example, about the educational agenda and the educational reform packages, they can't answer questions. And then when you start to get answers to those questions after the fact, everybody points at the other person and says, oh, the Senate made me do that, or the governor made me do that, or the Assembly made me do that. So from my perspective, the frustration is really a result of the fact that you cannot have a rich and full public policy debate where you can have an exchange of ideas and you can say, I agree with you on that, I disagree with you on that, here's my reasons. You know, Stephanie Miner, here is where you're wrong. Bill de Blasio, here's where you're wrong. Instead, it's all shrouded. And some people seem to be able to break through that and get what they want. Those people also seem to be the ones who contribute a lot of campaign contributions, while others of us are left saying, we don't understand the implications of that vote. We're going to have to wait to find out what the implications of those votes are. And, you know, you're the ones who are going to have to deal with these things. For example, on the school system, the educational reform that was voted on, the teachers, the parents, the families in the city of Syracuse, they call me and my office and ask us what it means. So it is more than a little bit awkward to have to say to them, I'm not sure, and I don't know. But another part of what you were talking about, where there's been discussed a lot, is the tactics involved. And you know, look, politics ain't beanbag, and I understand that, and I'm involved in the process. But I don't think it behooves anybody to have ad hominem, anonymous attacks where you go after somebody personally or otherwise, and at the same time that you are deliberately restricting public debate and discussion of issues. And, you know, I agreed with the SAFE Act vote, and I am for meaningful gun control. But I think what you saw in the aftermath of the SAFE Act was a group of people who probably would have never supported the SAFE Act to begin with, but have been able to get a lot of traction by the fact that they said, where was the debate? Where was the discussion? Where was the meaningful give and take? Because after all, when you live in a democracy, you have to have the consent of the governed to move forward, even if you disagree with what the laws are. And that's where I think you're seeing the frustration come out of that.
This seems to, as did Mayor de Blasio's comments, seems to call for a change in the way that the public policy process in New York State works. Saying we should have a more deliberative process, which has a lot of structural implications, that we need a functioning committee system, for example, that in the New York legislature, the party conferences are the backbone of the system, and the standing committees, while some of them make a contribution, it's really the chairs that make a contribution, and they aren't debating bodies. They aren't deliberative bodies. They don't do markups of legislation. So it seems to be hankering for a fundamental restructuring of the public policy process. And Governor Cuomo's response to Mayor de Blasio seemed to be flip. Welcome to Albany. So the governor sort of is accepting the way the system currently works and in effect saying we can't change Albany, so we have to learn just to play the game. And the Mayor de Blasio is expressing dissatisfaction with the way the game is played.
Well, let me give you another example, an illustration of where the problem for me lies. So I, for a long time, when I came into office, started talking about the issue of pensions and the fact that our pension bills were exponentially increasing, and it was an incredible burden for the city of Syracuse and other cities. And then the governor's folks said that they had an answer for it, and it was what they called pension smoothing, and which I referred to as pension borrowing. And then shortly after, I said that I had more questions than answers, and then I said I disagreed with that because I didn't think it was a fiscally responsible policy. I was subject to all sorts of anonymous ad hominem attacks and threats and phone calls. And then, you know, fast forward 2 or 3 years later, and you see Puerto Rico is going belly up because they engaged in pension borrowing. Chicago is on the brink because they engaged in pension borrowing. Illinois is on the brink because they engaged in pension borrowing. Detroit declared bankruptcy because they engaged in pension borrowing. And so for me, I was willing to take that risk and engage in that process because I thought it was a fiscally irresponsible public policy that was being proposed. And rather than have an open debate where the other side said, no, let us tell you why we think this is responsible or why this is the option that we should engage in and why we should move forward with this, it was decided that the best tactics were attacks, threats, and bullying. Well, we're never going to get good public policy if that's what we agree is the way, or we say, oh, that's just the way Albany is, and that's just the way we have to conduct ourselves. I don't think that Albany was that way under Hugh Carey. I don't think that it always has to be that way, and I think the people of our state deserve a better democracy where there's transparency and they understand public policies, there's a debate and a discussion, and people are held accountable for what they vote on, and that they understand what they vote on.
So in the current political environment, at one point for several years, you were the one of the co-chairs of the state Democratic Committee. You co-chaired that with Keith Wright, who's an assemblyman from Manhattan. You were very much a participant in the party process. Do you think that that's sort of the direction that politics is going right now? And how were you able to sort of balance the two as statewide co-chair of the party?
Well, I balanced it for a while, and then when I felt like I couldn't, I resigned. I don't think it's the way that the party is going, and I'm active in the party in both with Nassau County, and I was there is a candidate running for the mayor of Oswego, who will be the first woman mayor in Oswego. I was up helping her last week, and I talked with the folks from Erie County. So I don't think that that's the way the party is going. I don't think that that's what the party faithful and workers want. I can tell you firsthand that it's not. They're the ones who are out in front on issues, for example, against fracking. They were the ones out in front on women's equality, all of those issues. So I think that this is kind of the classic case where the so-called leaders have to catch up to the people.
That's interesting. I mean, it does seem like at this point in time that politics is trumping policy at every turn. In New York State. Speaking of policy, which is near and dear to my heart, I wanted to ask you about funding for cities, in particular AIM funding, the Aid and Incentive to Municipalities funding stream, formerly called Urban Aid. This is a state funding stream where the state shares back tax revenues with the cities, towns, and villages from which it was collected. This funding stream has been, I would suggest, almost decimated over the last 30 years. In terms of real dollars, it's down anywhere from 75 to 80% for cities, towns, and villages. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, do you think that that needs to be increased? Is that a good funding stream? I mean, certainly it seems like the governor is blaming cities, towns, and villages for the woes of New York State, at least the financial woes, saying you have to get your fiscal house in order. But at the same time, he's been cutting funding to the local level, asking everybody to do more with less. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, look, I think increasing AIM aid is one option, but also eliminating or reducing our state mandates is another. And the state doesn't seem to want to do either. And then they put a cap on property taxes, and then they force municipalities to engage in just these horrendous financially irresponsible decisions like pension borrowing. So they say, we're not going to give you revenue. We're not going to do anything about your mandates. Your pension costs are going to continue to rise. Your infrastructure is going to continue to deteriorate. And here, you can borrow to pay your pensions, which will give you a little bit of money to help you keep those pools open or buy fire trucks or buy police cars. The Pew Charitable Trust did a study, I think it was last month, where they came out and showed that of the 50 states, New York was 49th in pushing its costs down. Those are, of course, mandated costs. So as long as New York, you know, if it is a, if the Albany legislators say, you know, this is a state standard and we want this to be a state standard from Montauk to Buffalo, then I think they should pay that bill. If it's not a state standard, then they should allow localities to determine how to pay it or what the standard should be. Unfortunately, they want the best of both worlds. They want to be able to take credit for a program or a policy or an initiative, but they don't want to pay for it. And they're asking mayors and county executives to pay for these policies. And as a consequence, you see a lot of municipalities engaging in pension borrowing and pension smoothing, even though that they know that it's not fiscally responsible, even though Wall Street has told them not to do it, and even though now we have the models of Chicago and Detroit and Puerto Rico right in front of us. But You know, when you're a local government official, you have to arrest the bad guys, you have to put out the fires, you have to plow streets and pick up trash, and you have to figure out a way to do that.
In many ways, it really seems like the deck is stacked against you as an upstate mayor, because as you mentioned, you know, so the state has cut off some of the revenue that the cities rely on by capping property taxes. The state has cut off resources by cutting state aid that the cities rely on, and that the whole system was built upon, that the, you know, a percentage of the state revenues would come back to the cities, and then at the same time pushing down the mandates to local mayors. It seems like a job where you're sort of dancing on one leg trying to keep the lights on.
It is a great job though, and you can do really meaningful work and help people, and that at the end of the day makes every mayor's job worthwhile.
What do you see as the possibility of reallocation of functions? In other words, what should cities be paying for? What should counties be paying for? And what should the state be paying for? Should there be a reallocation of responsibilities in a way that recognizes different primary responsibilities for different levels of government?
I think what you're going to see is that the fiscal realities of governments is going to force that discussion. Now, I think it would behoove us all to have that discussion now before a crisis hits, because it'll give us more time to make sure that there are not victims in this process and to make sure that we evenly pass out the sacrifices. But, you know, the nature of democracy is such that often you don't force people's hands until there is a crisis. And given the number of municipalities that are on the brink of fiscal insolvency or engaging in decisions that are, you know, not going to lead them to a good place, I think sooner rather than later, this is going to be a discussion that the state has.
Hmm. Let me ask a question, too. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about child poverty, since it's such an important issue. And clearly our upstate cities are absolutely struggling with this, with the child poverty rates hovering around 50% in many, if not most, of our upstate cities. Do you feel like we're doing enough to address that? And what would you suggest we do?
No, we're clearly not. It is an incredible tragedy of the number of children, particularly children of color, who are born into poverty and live in poverty. And then when you put together the studies that are being done, Raj Chetty out of Harvard or MIT, showing that the data shows that the zip code that you're born into will dictate your financial position when you die. So the numbers show that if you are a child born into poverty, that there is very little hope, based on data, of upward mobility. And so to the extent that there is a panacea for any of this, it is education. And while we spend in New York State the most per student of virtually any of the other states, what you have to do is, you know, look at that further and show that where we're spending the most per child is in wealthy suburbs and school districts. And that's fantastic, and that's great that we're doing that, but we cannot shortchange children in poor cities and school districts, because what we're doing then is giving them a proverbial death sentence. And so we need to invest in urban school centers and make them places where we can help families out of poverty, make sure that children get what they need, families get what they need, so that they can focus on education and move forward.
Well said. This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we've had the pleasure of speaking with Stephanie Miner, the mayor of the city of Syracuse. Mayor Miner, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for coming on,
Appreciate
Mayor.
Appreciate it.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm joined here in the WRPI studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute and New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. Please join us again on Tuesday, August 18th, but right now, stay tuned for Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!